This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. On August 12, 1994, Major League Baseball players walked off the job after months of failed labor negotiations.
The Expos leave the field in first place, yet wondering if their best season ever's in jeopardy. Even so, they're prepared to sit it out for as long as it takes.
A month later, Acting Commissioner Bud Selig canceled the remaining regular season and the entire postseason. That's when the President of the United States stepped in to help. Or he tried to. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
In the fall of 1994, angst filled the void created by the loss of baseball. Fans of the game were still struggling with the idea that there'd be no World Series for the first time in 90 years.
It was shocking. It was just horrendous.
That's Bud Selig.
That was a really, really dismal time in baseball. People were angry. They were angry with everybody, including the commissioner, I may add. I got a call from the White House to meet with President Clinton.
There was a history of U.S. presidents getting involved in sports. Teddy Roosevelt called for rule changes to make football safer. FDR told Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis that MLB should carry on during World War II. Selig hopped on a plane in Milwaukee and arrived in D.C. for the meeting on October 14th.
President Clinton said to me, you know, this is unfortunate, and we find ourselves in a tough position, and I'd really like to help in solving it, so I'm going to appoint a mediator, if you agree, by the name of Bill Ussery.
Ussery was a former Secretary of Labor who'd been appointed to arbitrate labor disputes by every U.S. president, from Harry S. Truman to Gerald Ford. The 70-year-old Ussery was also trusted by Clinton and by Major League Baseball Players Association head Donald Fear. Everyone agreed that Ussery was the man for the job, but Clinton had a stipulation for both parties.
And this is the crucial thing, that whatever Ussery came up with, we would accept.
The sides negotiated into January of 1995, but made little progress. Then the White House set a deadline of February 6th for a settlement. But Ussery still couldn't bring the sides close to an agreement.
They were tough, very, very tough meetings. Bill Ussery and I hollered at each other a lot, as much as I liked them, by the way. You know, these are difficult issues.
The sides quibbled over the salary cap, free agency, how much payroll tax teams should pay, and how to distribute that revenue to the league's smaller clubs.
We didn't agree on a lot of things, but there was a dialogue.
On February 7th, after the deadline for a new agreement had expired, and as the time for spring training approached, Selig went back to Washington to meet with Bill Ussery.
And he gave me his plan, and you know, to be very candid with you, I liked it, but there are a lot of parts of it I didn't like.
Selig knew the owners wouldn't be happy about Ussery's recommendation of a 50% luxury tax on payrolls above $40 million per season, but
I said, well, I gave my word on October 14th to the president that I'd accept what you came up with, so I don't have a choice. And he said he was going to see the union, and they'd be back to us. That's when the tough part began.
Selig went back to his hotel to brief the owners. Then he waited.
And now it's 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. We started calling everybody that we knew. Senators, Joe Lieberman, Chris Dodd, Herb Kohl. But nobody knew anything. Finally, at 5 o'clock, we get a call to meet at the White House.
Selig figured the union had also agreed on Ussery's terms and that there'd be a new labor deal just in time for a full 1995 MLB season. Selig walked into the Roosevelt Room for a private meeting.
There's Don Fear with a bunch of players. And I can see by the look on Bill Ussery's face, there's trouble. The meeting starts. President Clinton says a few words, and everybody's there, Robert Reich, the Labor Secretary, George Stephanopoulos, and Vice President Gore. Al Gore kind of took over, and Al Gore says this deal will not work, union won't accept it, and I'm stunned.
Selig says he glanced at Bill Clinton. He had expected the president to hold the union to its word that it would accept Ussery's recommendations. Clinton quickly looked away and then ducked out of the Roosevelt Room. After a desperate last-minute attempt to hammer out an agreement, the meeting ended abruptly. Later, Seeley ran into Ussery in a hallway.
And Bill Ussery said, "Harry S. Truman never did this to me. Dwight David Eisenhower never did this to me. John F. Kennedy didn't. And even Richard Nixon didn't do this to me." And I could see he was really upset.
As they talked, Seelig was summoned to the Oval Office to meet privately with Bill Clinton.
I said to him, "Mr. President, I gave my word, as you did, that whatever Bill Ussery came up with, we'd accept." And then all of a sudden the door opened, maybe conveniently. In comes all the same cast of characters, at which point the president kind of disappeared. Vice President Gore took over.
Seelig believed Gore was putting his pro-labor constituency above his pledge to help resolve MLB's impasse.
I sat there really in shock. I finally blew up and my language was tough.
Seelig says F-bombs were involved.
I said to him, "You people have double-crossed us, and now we're going to start over again." And that was the end of that session. It was a deeply disappointing session.
In March of 1995, U.S. District Judge Sonia Sotomayor, now a Supreme Court justice, issued an injunction that restored the terms of the previous agreement and ordered the sides to keep negotiating. The players returned to the field for a slightly abbreviated 1995 season. The league and the union finally agreed to a new deal in March of 1997. Major League Baseball began the work of winning back its fans.
They were angry at the players, which you didn't want, angry at the owners. Everybody was angry at the commissioner. But what did it lead to? It was only when we went to labor peace that we started setting attendance records and everything else.
Seelig likes to claim that the league has enjoyed labor peace since those negotiations. And that's true if you don't count the near strike in 2002 after the league insisted that players submit to random testing for performance-enhancing drugs. That was in response to that epic and slightly fraudulent home run race featuring Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, which, when you really think about it, was the main reason the fans came back. So maybe not everything Bud Seelig says is exactly true, but I hope he was on the level when he told me about all of those F-bombs bouncing off the walls of the White House.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Bud Seelig's new book is For the Good of the Game. It's time for three stories you should know.
The kneeling was not about a job. It was about injustice. Let me bring attention to injustice.
That was rapper Jay-Z speaking at a press conference with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell on Wednesday, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thrilled to be here, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
Jay-Z's entertainment company, Roc Nation, has entered into a partnership with the NFL to expand the league's entertainment offerings and, oh yeah, try to tackle the league's social justice issues. Jay-Z has been a vocal Colin Kaepernick supporter, and just last summer he released a song boasting about turning down the Super Bowl halftime show, which I can't help but mention is an unpaid gig. So now people are asking, did Jay-Z sell out? Panthers safety Eric Reed has called the partnership disingenuous. Journalist Jamel Hill is wondering how Jay-Z could accept such a deal without Colin Kaepernick's involvement. On the other hand, Jay-Z is a pretty powerful and persuasive guy. You could do a lot worse than him if you're looking for someone to help the NFL make real changes in the way it sees these issues. And part of me really wants to believe that something good can come out of this. Charlotte, am I being overly optimistic here?
Yeah.
It's okay. I can take it.
I mean, I think for me, the whole thing is like, look, these are two extremely rich guys, right?
Yeah.
Jay-Z's holding out to not perform at the Super Bowl. I read on Twitter, I can't remember who said this, someone was like, it seems like he was just waiting for a better offer. And Mike Freeman at Bleacher Report wrote something about how Jay-Z says that he's trailblazing or that he's continuing to further the cause and we should move forward rather than talking about how Colin Kaepernick still doesn't have a job. And Eric Reid, as you mentioned, he fired back and he said, those aren't mutually exclusive. You can further the cause and Kaepernick cannot have been blackballed. Like, it's not rocket science. And I just think at the end of the day, money wins out. I think it's that clear. And he's kind of the league's Band-Aid now in some ways. He's a guy that Goodell can point to and be like, hey, you know, well, we have Jay-Z on our side. How could you say we're not progressive? And I think a lot of people have been pretty disappointed.
It is surprising to me that he would do this without Kaepernick knowing about it, without having a conversation with Kaepernick. I mean, if one day Kaepernick comes out and says just simply, Jay-Z really disappointed me, or Jay-Z sold out. I mean, everything that Jay-Z built up, all right, that's too far because he's, you know, the first rap billionaire. But it would damage his credibility to such an extent. I would think that a savvy guy like Jay-Z would know about that.
I mean, Jay-Z did say something very vague about, like, well, maybe there's a way to give Kaepernick a platform, even if it's not on the field, which I think is exactly what the NFL doesn't want to do. So I find the whole thing really bizarre, but at least the Super Bowl halftime show will get better.
Right.
Yeah, we won't have to rely on Adam Levine taking his shirt off.
All right, Charlotte, you're up.
So this week, mediation fell apart between the women's U.S. national team and U.S. soccer. So that means that their case for equal pay will go to trial sometime in 2020. And Megan Rapinoe said on Good Morning America that they won't accept anything but equal pay. And, you know, look, there are a lot of moving parts to this case. It's super complicated. U.S. soccer says that the women aren't representing the case fairly. And the women are like, look, we're not paid what the men are. Yeah. And we have worse facilities. We have worse support. They should be paid equally, even if they were 10 times worse than the men. But they are 30 million times better. I mean, you might recall the men didn't even make the last World Cup, let alone win four of them. I think the key thing here is that, and what's so inspiring for me, at least, is the women are fighting for what they believe in. And I'm really thrilled to see these women standing up and just taking it public and, you know, going to trial with it.
Mike?
How oppositional do you like us to be in these segments?
Bring it on.
Do you think the Minnesota Lynx should be paid more than the New York Knicks, Charlotte?
I think they should be paid the same amount as the New York Knicks, Mike.
Okay. I'm glad we had that quick back and forth because I think that says it all. I think that most people who understand how economics works knows that that is not the capitalistic society we live in. The Minnesota Lynx make – they're an extremely successful, the most successful WNBA team. But they make so much less money that, of course, they shouldn't be paid enough. They should be valued as much. They should be given every opportunity. And I do think – I want to caveat this and say all the quality of the field and forcing the women to play on AstroTurf a turf that needs to be equal. That's just safety and what's right. Now, I would love them to get as much pay as they can. At this point, I don't think it's a civil rights issue as much as it is a regular old contract negotiation where each side's trying to press their advantage.
I like that you bring in the idea of capitalism here. You're right. There are rules to capitalism, but U.S. soccer is a nonprofit and their mission isn't to make money. Their stated mission is to grow the game of soccer. So if they're not investing in growing both sides of the game equally, that is a problem. There's also issues related to how the math is being done, and the math is pretty squirrely here. So in fact, it's quite possible that, for example, the Women's World Cup is worth as much to Fox as the Men's World Cup is. Certainly Fox charged as much for commercials and had as many revenue opportunities as they did in the Men's World Cup. But U.S. Soccer bundles that together and pretends that the Women's World Cup is just a freebie bonus. And that's part of why the money here is so wacky.
Of course this is a civil rights issue. You talk about the Lynx, like, of course they shouldn't be paid what the Knicks are. That's a societal issue. The fact that society, that we do not put enough money, we don't put enough resources, we don't put enough publicity, we don't put enough behind women's sports in general is not the players' fault. I'm so frustrated by this sort of, sure, capitalism, economics, whatever. It's deeply unfair. So maybe if we could make it a little more fair, then the money would follow.
I want it to be fair. I would love for them to get as much money as possible. What I'm saying is right now they're engaged in a negotiation, and the women are going to say we're not the subject to equal pay, and their negotiating partners are going to say, here are many ways where you have, and they'll eventually come to an agreement. If I'm doing off-Broadway Chekhov and The Rock is doing Fast and the Furious 7, I'm going to get paid less. It's not a societal issue. It's a dollars and cents issue.
To equate women's sports with being an off-Broadway Chekhov play and the men are the blockbuster is absurd.
All right, we could talk about this one all day, but Mike, why don't you close us out?
John Lester is a very good pitcher, but there's one aspect, he pitches for the Cubs, there's one aspect of pitching he's not good at. In fact, he's horrible at it, and which is holding a base runner on. Guy gets on base, takes a lead. He cannot throw to a base. He has something called the yips. For years, this was a huge problem, and people used to run on him like crazy. But this year, if you look at the stats, through savvy and cunning and sometimes bouncing a ball to the base, he's way above average on keeping runners on. He has found a way to kind of hack his mainframe, staring at the runner, using his catcher to throw behind the runner. Takes a little amount of time. He works pretty slow, but it's a marvel to watch.
The yips are something in sports that I think I could talk about endlessly because, you know, how many of us know that feeling of this deep level of competence and something that we have been able to do our whole lives, and then you think about it so much or you worry about it so much or there's so much weight attached to it that you just kind of fall apart. It's so easy to view athletes as these machines, and then their humanity comes through, and I always feel so much for the guys going through it because I'm like, yeah, man, trust me, we have all been there.
Charlotte, I think I love this story for kind of similar reasons, but I'm going to get really, really geeky with it. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So superheroes, they have to have some sort of fatal flaw. Kryptonite, it exists because otherwise nobody would ever beat Superman, but it also exists because without kryptonite, Superman is pretty hard for us mere mortals to relate to. So throwing out base runners is John Lester's kryptonite, except that he's completely managed to work around it. It's like when Supergirl died and the only thing that could bring her back was sunlight, but it was nighttime, so she leached sunlight from plants and rose from the dead.
That's exactly what it's like. It's like, you know, he does a slide step too, but it's mostly like leaching the sunlight off of plants.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
Why would a cycling champion from the turn of the 20th century appear in an ad for a cognac brand in 2019? The answer is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal, dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
There's a multivitamin that can make our lives instantly better. All we need to get its benefits is to step outside.
Nature and parks and greenery helps us be our better selves.
The miracle of vitamin N in the latest episode of our U2.0 series on Hidden Brain from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. If you were watching Super Bowl 53 in February, you probably saw a commercial for the cognac brand Hennessy. It was narrated by rapper Nas and featured a dramatic retelling of the life of Major Taylor.
By 1901, Major Taylor raced all over the world in search of a true rival. He never found one.
But who was Major Taylor? What's his connection to Hennessy? And why is the brand so popular in the African-American community? To answer those questions, we have to explore the last 150 years of American history. Here's Only a Game's Nico Emack.
If you're Black, you've probably heard of Hennessy. For nearly a century, the cognac brand has built a lasting relationship with the African-American community.
I would say my earliest memory would be hearing it in songs before I could legally drink. They wanna nose my role model. It's in the brown bottle. It had this, you know, mystery around it, like, ooh, yeah, this is the thing to drink.
That's Bianca Holman, a journalist for KLAS 8 in Las Vegas. I connected with her after I read her reporting on the history of Hennessy and hip-hop.
And then finally, when I got to college, I went to Howard University in Washington, D.C., and ended up going to a party at one of the bigger clubs. You know, this is when Kanye's rise was happening, right? And so I don't know if you remember the rapper Twista.
Of course. He's the fastest man alive.
I remember it was in Slow Jams. And he mentioned Hennessy. When it come to rocking the rhythm like Marvin and Luther, I can tell you when I'm messing with Kyle, man, the twist on the shot, and I'll be sipping Hennessy. Cause I'm a Ruby, while I smoke a B, you can pick with me, put it on the G. And now I'm like, hey, you know, you had raising the bottle up, like, yes.
But to understand how Hennessy became the pop culture phenomenon that it is today, and how any of it relates to a world-renowned cyclist and one of the first ever African-American world champions in any sport, we have to go back.
Bicycling in the 1890s was the most popular sport in the country, much more popular at the time than baseball, for example.
That's Michael Cranish, a political investigative reporter for the Washington Post. He recently wrote a book on Major Taylor.
At the time, he was a very well-known sports figure, and a lot of sports writers liked to write about him because they saw this as not just a sporting contest, but as a young black man who was trying to take on his shoulders to disprove a lot of the racist theories at the time.
Marshall Major Taylor got his nickname growing up in Indianapolis during the 1890s. Taylor would perform bicycle tricks while wearing his dad's old Civil War uniform outside a bike shop owned by a man named Bertie Munger. Taylor would draw big crowds and help Munger sell bikes. But one day, when Taylor was still a teenager, Munger had a different idea.
He took Taylor to a racetrack, and he was astonished to see how fast Taylor was in the track. Taylor actually came close unofficially to beating a world record.
Munger began managing Taylor and started entering him in races across Indianapolis, breaking the color barrier in cycling 50 years before Jackie Robinson would in baseball. Major Taylor kept winning, and people hated him for it.
The local YMCA would not allow him to train there because he was black. The racism got so bad that there was a time in which his manager, Bertie Munger, actually brought a vial of a liquid which was supposed to make a black person look white. And one day, Munger applied this lotion to Taylor, and while it did lighten his skin somewhat, it caused incredible pain, and eventually they had to abandon this idea. But it just underscores how incredibly difficult the times were for Taylor and the incredible odds that he had to overcome.
At the age of 18, Major Taylor turned pro and moved to Worcester, Massachusetts. Worcester had its own problems with racism, but at least Major Taylor was allowed to train at the local YMCA. In 1896, Munger entered him into the six-day race, one of the toughest and most prestigious races in all of cycling.
The six-day race is really an inhumane race. It would never be allowed today, probably, but at the time, you were basically supposed to race as many miles as you could and laps around the track for a six-day period. You could take breaks, you could rest for an hour, but then you lost some of the time to your competition.
Most racers dropped out. Some even died. But Major Taylor kept going.
Sometimes he would just get an hour or two of sleep. The first night, perhaps he got as many as 6 hours. But oftentimes it'd be an hour here, an hour there. And the newspapers of the time would describe him as doubled over in pain and wincing in agony. At one point, they described him mindlessly wandering across the track due to lack of sleep and being carried off in a trainer's arms. And there was another point at which he told his trainers, and I'm quoting here, "I cannot go on with safety, for there is a man chasing me around the ring with a knife in his hand." So you can just imagine the exhaustion that he was feeling to have said that.
Major Taylor finished eighth. He biked 1,732 miles during the 1896 six-day race. For perspective, 1896 was the same year that the Supreme Court ruled in Plessy versus Ferguson, making racial segregation constitutional. Throughout his career, Major Taylor broke over a dozen world records. But despite his accomplishments, he was often treated with more respect outside of the U.S. In his book, Michael Cranis writes about Major Taylor's experience living and competing in France.
In fact, he came to France in part because he could be treated more as an equal. He was venerated by the French cycling press. They published pictures of him. So they really lauded him in a way that Taylor could not be celebrated back home in the United States.
And when Major Taylor won a world championship in Montreal in 1899,
he said he never felt more American than when the anthem was played for him in Canada, because in America, he was often banned or ridiculed for racist reasons. So when he won the championship, oftentimes he carried an American flag that he had tucked into his jersey, and he would pull it out and wave it in celebration. So he was proud to be an American and wished that America was as proud of him as he was of the country that he came from.
Major Taylor was celebrated abroad. People in France cared more about his accomplishments than his skin color. It's the same feeling that many black intellectuals, musicians, and athletes wrote about in the early 1900s. It's also the same experience that many African-American troops described during World War II when, just like Major Taylor, they traveled thousands of miles across the Atlantic to fight for a country that wouldn't fight for them.
When they were deployed, it was a period of sort of independence. And if you can imagine going from, you know, the Jim Crow South into a society where people were actually happy to have you on their side because of the role you played in the freedom of their country, they would have had much more respect.
That's Christine Sismondo, author of America Walks Into a Bar, a book that traces the relationship between bars, spirits, and progressive movements in American history.
There are a few different stories about the connection between African-American soldiers and cognac. And one of them is that, you know, on Liberation Day, every soldier got a bottle of cognac that, you know, farmers would kind of find their hidden stores of cognac buried underneath, you know, the potatoes or whatever, and that they were giving them away.
Since the American Revolution, whiskey has been very popular in the United States, especially in the South. And throughout this time, many companies used racist imagery in their advertising. The U.S. Library of Congress has archived many of these images. They feature caricatures of African Americans.
Almost every whiskey company would have been really trying to sell largely to a white clientele. There would have been informal policies to not sell to the African American community. Certainly, probably the fact that you were using such absolutely culturally offensive stereotypes on the advertising would have reinforced that.
Sismondo says that many African Americans contributed to the whiskey industry. And ironically enough,
you know, Jack Daniels was named specifically after one person, and he's sort of posited as this individual genius who came up with charcoal filtration in order to make this really pure whiskey. And, you know, there's probably a bit of truth to that, but charcoal filtration seems to also have had a longer history that extended into slave communities as well.
So when African-American troops returned home from Europe, reinvigorated with a sense of worldliness and freedom, they opted to drink cognac.
If you think about the soldiers coming back and having been exposed to different things around the world,
adds Bianca Holman,
and cognac, especially in France and Europe, you're like, oh, wow, if Uncle Charles is bringing this back and saying and drinking this, and he's international, he's traveled, he's a respected person in our family, this must be it. So I think those habits began to just, you know, trickle on down.
By the 1950s, cognac had become the drink of choice for African Americans. But according to Bianca Holman, cognac companies didn't yet see the African American community as a viable market. That's where Herb Douglas comes in. He won bronze in long jump at the 1948 Summer Olympics, and he was hired to work for Hennessy in the 1960s.
He's very important because having that athletic background, many people, even for today, you may think, oh, that person's just going to stay into athletics. But no, he was able to rise into the ranks of being a vice president of urban marketing for the Hennessy brand during the 1960s.
Here he is at 92 years old, talking about his career in a Hennessy ad.
We had to prove ourselves that what? We could compete. We had to prove ourselves that we can sell. That's why
Douglas pushed for Hennessy to advertise more in popular African-American publications.
So if you think about Ebony, Jet, that's what we were reading. That's what was in the barbershops, in the beauty salons. That was what was on your grandmother's coffee table. That's what we were looking at as beacons of light and what was happening in our community.
And Hennessy took Douglas's advice.
They were one of the first to really have authentic and genuine advertisements in those publications. Their advertisements weren't these stereotypical caricatures. An ad that sticks out for me is there's this guy standing at the door and, you know, of his lady friend's house. And, you know, it's like, oh, you kind of came over for a cocktail, and he's holding the bottle of Hennessy. And they're dressed really nice and clean and cut. And it's like, oh, yeah, that could be my postal worker, or that could be the guy at my church or something. And these people that they had in their ads looked normal and regular and like something that was real to the everyday person.
But it wasn't just these ads that allowed Hennessy to corner the African-American market. It was a genuine investment in the community and its leaders. They even were the first ever corporate sponsor of the NAACP.
And it looks as though Major Taylor is making a go for it. He's working hard.
So it makes sense why Hennessy would want to promote Major Taylor's story in 2019, 87 years after his death. But why did Michael Cranish want to write about Major Taylor?
I really wanted to write this as a piece of history. What does he tell us about the times? And I see him, because he was so well documented, as a lens into this era, which is so important for understanding American history and in many ways still defines our country. When we look at some of the divisions that still exist today, I think his story has even more to teach us than ever before.
More recently, Hennessy has employed Erykah Badu, Nas, and Rihanna as brand ambassadors. And the brand continues to be mentioned by artists and athletes alike.
I need a one dance, got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go.
Major Taylor was the perfect guy to represent the Hennessy brand. But it's worth noting, you never would have seen him drinking it.
Taylor did abstain from alcohol, but Taylor did also say at the same time he was not trying to impose his lifestyle on others.
That story comes from Only a Game's Nico Emack. Michael Cranish's book is called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Gabby Grant was 7 years old when her father retired from professional lacrosse.
All I remember is that every time that my dad was on the field, he would get like a goal in like every 10 minutes.
Coming up, John Grant Jr. returns to the game for his daughter. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Hey everyone, it's Ophira Eisenberg, and here I'm chatting with one of Queer Eye's Fab Five, Anthony Perowski. What's a culinary deal breaker for you?
Ketchup on hot dogs makes me really uncomfortable.
Listen to NPR's Ask Me Another, the answer to life's funnier questions.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the story of the NFL veteran who learned to play football at Middlebury College. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
DeMarcus Cousins ruptured his Achilles in January of 2018. He made it back for 30 games last season before tearing his quadriceps in April. He came back from that just in time to tear his ACL in an off-season workout on Monday. What's going on?
I don't know. The guy is clearly talented, and he was going to be a big part of what the NBA was hoping was going to be a giant revival on the part of the Lakers this year. That will now be a good-sized revival, I'm sure, because Anthony Davis is still there, and so is LeBron James. But this is just too bad. I mean, there isn't much you can do to a leg that he hasn't done.
Well, Cousins signed a one-year, $3.5 million deal with the Lakers in July. He, of course, was hoping to prove himself over this season and sign a bigger deal after that. What comes next for him?
My guess is he's going to be on the market again next year, only this time with, you know, a red check mark next to his ACL on his resume.
The NCAA has amended the Rich Paul rule so that it no longer applies to NBA agent Rich Paul. This comes after pretty much everyone pointed out the ridiculousness of requiring agents to have bachelor's degrees, especially given the fact that one of the most successful and well-respected agents doesn't have one. Would you like to commend the NCAA for listening to reason for once?
I would like to commend the NCAA for listening to reason for once, but the only reason the NCAA went back on this is because the most famous basketball player in the world, and arguably the 1A best player of all time, raise the stink about it.
Well, agents are already certified by the NBA Players Association. So now that we've got the most ridiculous part of the rule out of the way, what's the point of the NCAA requiring additional certification at all?
Once again, everything the NCAA does is a mechanism of control over the unpaid workforce. They will tell you it's to keep kids from being cheated by unscrupulous street agents, and that occasionally does happen. But that's not why the NCAA made the rule.
The NFL has suspended New York Giants wide receiver Golden Tate for the first four games of the season. Tate took a medication prescribed by a fertility doctor. He discovered days later that it was on the banned list, immediately stopped taking it. So absolutely, let's throw the book at him, right?
Yep. You know, a lot of times you'll hear ridiculous excuses from athletes about how they happened to take a banned substance. And,
right.
You know, it was in their peanut butter or something. This is legit. Everybody agrees that this is what happened to Golden Tate. His wife in here trying to have children. He took a drug that was recommended by a fertility doctor. It had a banned ingredient that nobody was aware of. Certainly Tate wasn't. And they're going to suspend him for four games anyway. And they've just turned down his appeal. So he's stuck. But I have a feeling that, shall we call him eventually, you know, little kid Tate is going to grow up and sue the NFL for having slandered him before birth.
The Ohio State University has applied to trademark the word "the" when used in conjunction with the university's name, and people are not happy about it, right, Charlie?
Well, people think it's silly, and of course, the you know ground zero for mockery is the University of Michigan,
who's now going after the word "of."
Yes, they are now going to trademark the word "of." The signs behind the anchor desk of college football game day on ESPN this year, every time that Ohio State plays, are just going to be priceless. I can't wait.
Simone Biles won her sixth all-around national gymnastics title over the weekend. Congrats to Simone. But I want to talk about the organization that crowned her. The U.S. Olympic Committee began decertification proceedings against USA Gymnastics 9 months ago. But according to the Wall Street Journal, many in that organization are hoping that the USOC will abandon that effort. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think that USA Gymnastics should disappear. And any steps that the USOC or anybody can take to hasten its death, I'm in favor of. And then you rebuild the organizing committee from the ground up. I mean, it's certainly not going to hurt you competitively. Simone Biles seems to be doing fine. There's an opportunity here to create a governing body by and for the athletes.
Yeah.
And not, you know, a bunch of guys in blazers grazing the buffets while Larry Nassar commits his crimes. Let USA Gymnastics be the cautionary tale on how to build a new governing body in the new age. I think Allie Raisman for president would be a fine idea.
And finally, Charlie, Mike Tyson has revealed exactly how much pot he and his friends smoke at his marijuana ranch every month, and it's a lot.
Well, depending on how good it is, I mean, it's $40,000 worth of prime weed. And may I just say that we started this segment with Boogie Cousins and his joints, and we're ending it with Michael Tyson and his joints.
Oh, boy.
Mike Tyson has gone into the weed business in
yes.
a huge way. And he's apparently getting high on his own product, which you're not supposed to do, but he seems to be doing fine with it.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
When John Grant Jr. announced his retirement from Major League Lacrosse in April of 2017, he sounded like a guy resigned to his fate.
I've been playing longer than I think anyone thought I would. My body retired in 2009, but I think my heart just finally can't propel myself to play anymore.
John was 42. His knees had been going for a long time. But the real problem was the concussion he'd suffered a few months earlier. He just hadn't been able to shake it. He had a family now, he told reporters. He needed to be there for them. In the video, John looks calm, retrospective, confident in his decision. But there were hints of doubt.
I mean, I just love this game. I've been playing literally since I was in diapers and, you know, I'm 42 now, so that, you know, 39 years ago, I picked up my dad's stick and started smacking people with it. And it's all I've ever done.
John Grant Jr. is the son of John Grant Sr., a legend in Canadian lacrosse. John grew up watching his dad play.
Yeah, I went to every game, every practice. It was kind of the family business.
When John was old enough to pick a number, his dad's number 12 wasn't available. So he asked for number 24 and decided to be twice as good as his dad. And he was.
No way! Score!
John's goals would send the commentators into fits and sometimes show up on ESPN.
Right hand by the back! Oh my God!
The Bulldogs over the shoulder shot! He scores! Oh, what a play by Junior!
That was ridiculous.
That's the best goal I've ever seen. I'll tell you what, SportsCenter top 10, number one.
I hope.
But this story isn't meant to be about John Grant Jr., the lacrosse player, or even John Grant Jr., the son. This story is meant to be about John Grant Jr., the dad. And that story begins in August of 2008. John was playing in a championship series for his hometown team, the Peterborough Lakers, when he fell and ruptured the bursa sac in his elbow. To make things worse, John was simultaneously playing in another championship series for the Rochester Rattlers of MLL. John's elbow swelled to the size of a tennis ball. He couldn't get his arm pads on.
We actually rented a cottage to kind of lay low and hang out in between games, and the doctor actually came out on his motorcycle and decided to drain it.
John was still in a lot of pain.
But won our first championship with the Rochester Rattlers on a Sunday, and then went and played in game 6 in the Eastern Canadian Championship.
That night, John blacked out from the pain. The infection had spread through his body and attacked his left ACL. It had been replaced 5 years earlier. His knee was the size of a basketball. He'd gone septic.
My wife was called to, you know, possibly say goodbye. Then they asked her if they could chop my leg off. And thankfully she said, no, don't do that. You know, 40 days in the hospital, lost 40 some odd pounds.
Doctors removed John's infected ACL. 4 months later, they operated again to give him a new one. He was back on the field 5 months after that. But John's brush with death had made him realize that he needed something in his life that was more important than lacrosse. So he talked to his wife, Reagan, about starting a family.
And Gabby came around March 14th, 2010, gave me something else to focus on, and then I had to grow up.
John says he's still working on that last part. John, Reagan, and Gabby moved to Colorado to start a new life. John got a job coaching lacrosse at a high school and continued to play professionally in MLL and NLL, that's the indoor league, and MSL, that's the league in Canada. Gabby came to all of John's home games. She was his biggest fan. Sort of.
I think it took everything in Reagan's power just to keep her seated, not running around and, you know, wanting to dance and sing. And she was more focused on the cheerleaders. She was into dancing and stuff.
All I remember is that every time that my dad was on the field, he would get, like, a goal in, like, every 10 minutes.
That's Gabby. She's 9 now.
And my favorite ones was his behind the back.
And did you have cheers you'd like to cheer for him?
I bet I did, but I don't remember.
Gabby does remember having a lot of fun at those games. But as Gabby was dancing along with the cheerleaders, the clock was ticking on her dad's career.
And now to lacrosse and John Grant Jr. I like to call him the Peyton Manning of lacrosse, a guy who's getting up.
Then in January of 2017, John got concussed, bad. By April, he still hadn't recovered. That's when MLL's Denver Outlaws asked John if he was interested in coaching in the pros. But if you think this is the part of the story where Gabby picks up her dad's stick and carries on her father's legacy, you'd be wrong. Because Gabby Grant hated playing lacrosse.
I was on, like, a half-boys, half-girls team, so whenever I played, the boys would just, like, tackle me, and I just got hurt a lot, and I didn't like it.
John says he didn't mind that his daughter hadn't taken to lacrosse. She tried tennis and golf, but she was bored. She needed a team sport.
Any team sport. She tried soccer, hated it.
Then Gabby tried basketball with her dad as her coach, and she liked it. So John decided to try his daughter on lacrosse once more.
This time around, she seems to, once she was able to catch, she had that light bulb moment in the backyard where she could catch, and I said, you know what, maybe we can get you playing again.
Before long, Gabby was hooked.
I'm older and tougher now, and I'm on a team with all girls, and I just like it a lot now.
What do you like about it?
I like that you get to score goals, and I like that you're on a team too, because after the games, we always go get Slurpees or ice cream after, and that's always fun.
Now that Gabby was playing lacrosse, she was better able to appreciate those behind-the-back and over-the-shoulder goals her dad was always making. Trouble was, John wasn't making those goals anymore. He was stuck on the sidelines, coaching, and Gabby didn't like it.
It was always funner watching him play than coaching, because I didn't really get to see him do anything.
Yeah, so when he was coaching, he's just like standing on the sides, what, talking to people?
Yeah.
Sometimes yelling, right?
Yeah.
John wanted to give his daughter what he'd had, lasting memories of watching her dad doing something he loved, and maybe some inspiration to go after her own dreams when her time came around. So on May 26th of this year, just 5 days before the start of the season...
All right, cue the breaking news sounder. The Denver Outlaws announcing late this afternoon... that legend John Grant Jr. is coming out of retirement.
John's return was billed as a chance for him to reclaim his spot atop the all-time career scoring list, which he did. Cynics called John's return a publicity ploy for the league, and it was that, too. But for John, it was something more. It was a chance to play another season as a family.
Gabby, what's it like watching your dad play now that you understand the game?
Well, now I see that he's, like, really the best player. Well, he used to be. And I get so mad when they don't pass it to him because they see him limping. I think that's why they don't pass to him. I really want him to score more goals.
Trust me, I want to score more goals, too. I used to get 15, 16 shots a game. Now sometimes I'm lucky if I get one or two. But if every once in a while I can get a goal on SportsCenter for Gabby to see, then that's icing on the cake. You know, people are asking, what about next year? I said, I'm not sure I'll be able to physically play next game. So we're just kind of living this one day at a time, one week at a time. And, you know, you could ask Gabby, but it's been a pretty amazing summer so far.
So Gabby, has it been amazing?
Well, it's been awesome and... I'm not ready to go back to school yet.
Me either.
Gabby, I read somewhere that you've already picked out what number you want to wear for lacrosse.
Yes, I want to be number 48 because I'm going to be 2 times better than Daddy.
You see the pattern emerging here.
Summer is coming to an end, but John Grant Jr. hopes to play for another ring. It would be his 6th when Major League Lacrosse holds its championship weekend in Denver in early October. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Kyrie Thompson. We had additional help this week from Matt Lissette and Paul Kahlo. Our intern is Arlo Moore-Bloom. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. We say goodbye this week to assistant producer Nico Emack. Nico, thanks for all your great reporting, and we'll all be cheering on the Cambridge Ringe and Latin boys soccer team this fall. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.